This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Fasig Tipton.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Fletcher.
The result will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to what promises to be another five-star edition of the show that trainers listen to. It is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton, and it's right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, with you once again. As always, you are listening to the show live throughout North America on Sirius 219, XM 201, or you're tuned in to our free live streaming or the archived podcast of the show, and you're doing that on our HRRN website at horseracingradio.net. Well, today's guest has had the privilege to be around many of the most legendary names in thoroughbred racing, both human and equine. It has been an unbelievable run. The 75-year-old Junction City, Kansas native has spent time with Hall of Fame trainer D-Wayne Lucas, as well as a man named Pletcher. No, not Todd Pletcher, but rather his father, JJ, who, by the way, appeared on this very same program in February of 2017, and you can check out the podcast of that show on our website as well. Since 1986, he has called Aiken, South Carolina, home, and that is where his story really goes to new heights. I am excited about this show and excited to welcome trainer Ron Stevens to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton, here this afternoon. Ron, appreciate the visit.
Well, nice to be able to do this, Mike.
Yeah, and really excited to hear your story and hear the stories about some of the legendary horses that you've had the privilege to be around. But I guess my first question is, what's it been like to have Aiken Training Track as your office for the past 30-plus years or so?
Well, it's been unbelievable. I mean, this is a historic place, worldwide known for 40 champions that have trained here. I've seen a lot of change. You know, when I came here in 1986, there were still old families, Winter Colony families, coming down from up north, the Whitneys, and Woody Stevens had a barn here. Claiborne was sending horses here, Green Tree. So a lot of those old horses, including Kelso, trained here, and a lot of history. It was bustling. We'd had three, sometimes close to 400 horses training on the track. And that has pretty much gone by the wayside. A lot of these old families have just, you know, the younger generation didn't pick up and carry on, and they've phased out, and now it's more of a business. More tracks are open. Horses are not coming here that much. A lot of places to break yearlings, a lot of competition. So, you know, that COVID and everything else, we're like the whole United States or the world right now. We're struggling, but the history's still here. It's still a beautiful place. It's just unbelievable stories, unbelievable horses, and so it's been a great ride.
There had to be a reason, Ron, that so many of those legendary names that you just mentioned made Aiken their, I guess I'll call it their winter home for training their top horses. What does Aiken offer that maybe other locations that break and train horses might not offer?
Well, I would put number one, climate. You know, we're warm. We rarely miss a day of training here, but we have climate change. We'll have a few freezes, early morning freezes, but can generally get out on the racetrack by 9 or 10 o'clock. But that's enough to kill parasites and keep the fly population down and do all that. And then we have the most beautiful springs and falls that you'll find anywhere. So, the grasses are good here. We've got, although we import most of our hay and alfalfa, you know, that the horses can thrive well here. And, it's just, number one, I'd say climate, but there's a lot of reasons to be here.
You know, Lexington, Kentucky is known as the horse capital of the world. Ocala, Florida might want to dispute that claim. But in Aiken, South Carolina, it's all about the horses and all about the thoroughbreds as well, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, you can make a case for all of those places, both of those places. But, you know, Kentucky, I wouldn't want to be an exercise rider up there galloping horses in January in Kentucky. And I know they're doing it. They're turning out nice horses. And Ocala is a wonderful place with great trainers and great people down there and turn out super horses. But again, the climate thing comes into it. In fact, you get down there, I think you've got a little more heat, you've got a little more humidity. I don't think they get the frost and so on that we get just a little bit up here.
I read an article that was written back in the late 90s. I think it was 1999. And it talked about the fact that when you come to Aiken, there is a sign that welcomes you that says, "Welcome to Aiken, thoroughbred country." I don't know if the sign is still there, if that's still part of the entrance to Aiken, but there are street signs that are adorned with horse heads, and you know, there's of course the Thoroughbred Hall of Fame that's located in Aiken, not the Hall of Fame, but an Aiken Thoroughbred Hall of Fame or South Carolina Thoroughbred Hall of Fame. So if you were to describe Aiken and the town and the atmosphere to people, how would you do it, Ron?
Well, unique. You know, we've got the shopping centers, we've got the big growth because people have found out about us and they're moving in here in swarms. But our horse community, our track, and our barns and area are right in the middle of town. But they kept the dirt roads, so we can ride horses on the dirt roads. I take horses down a dirt road for about three blocks, push a button to cross one paved road, and I'm in 2,000 acres of woods. That's bigger than Central Park in New York. And I can take a horse or a set of horses and go on a different trail every day for a month and never be on the exact same trail, take deviations. And there's hills and there's dry riverbeds and just, you know, I've loved taking older horses that are a little bit sour and a little bit rank down there, and usually feeling they're very, very fit. But sometimes by the time they get through the sand and gallop up a pretty steep hill, they're blowing a little bit. So it's a great change of pace mentally. And it's just unique. No motorized vehicles are allowed in these woods. It's only hikers and horses. And they have a few hunts with the hounds in there, but they tell us when that's going to happen so we can cooperate with the other horse disciplines, which there are just unbelievable amount of polo horses and show horses, and they're all thriving and doing well.
You know, that article also talked about the fact that a place like Aiken Training Track, at least back in the late 90s, maybe it's still that way today, I'll let you tell me, but it's not exactly easy to find. It's kind of off the beaten path a little bit and set back in there, which is what makes it such a pristine place to train and to raise a young horse.
Well, as I mentioned, the racetrack and barns are right in the middle of town, but we're a little bit off the, you know, we're 15 miles off of I-20.
Right.
To get out to I-95, if you were driving to Florida, it would take you an hour, hour and a half to get over here. But for owners that want to fly in, and that's an issue because a lot of owners like to send their horses to Florida because they can go to the races and then go watch their babies being broke, and that's all happening in Florida. We can't offer that, but we have Augusta with a very nice airport. We have Columbia that's about 45 minutes away. At the same way, it has a very nice airport. And even our local airport 5 miles away can land some pretty decent-sized jets there. So we can be reached, but we're a little bit off the beaten path as far as I-95, say.
Well, the training track opened in 1941. It's been the winter home of such champions as Kelso and Stage Door Johnny and Pleasant Colony and Conquistador Cielo, Summer Squall. The list goes on and on. There have been 40 alumni of that training track that have gone on to be crowned champions. We're going to spend time talking about many of those. If you've had the privilege, Ron, to be around so many of those, so we'll do that later in the program. But let's talk a little bit more about you and your background, and let's go back to the beginning. I mentioned that you grow up in Kansas, which, look, there have been a lot of great horsemen to come from Kansas, but it's not necessarily like a Lexington, Kentucky, or Ocala, or Aiken. It's not considered to be a horse capital of the world, at least thoroughbred capital. So how does a kid from Kansas find his way into working with thoroughbreds?
Well, it's an interesting story. I guess I was born with the love for horses innate somewhere. because I grew up on a farm. I had two brothers and two sisters. My dad farmed, then went in. You know, he'd get up in the morning and milk the cows and do what he needed to do. Then he worked full-time at a post office, come home in the evening and milk cows again. And I was trying to milk cows when I was 7, 8 years old. Could never keep up with Dad, even when I was a teenager. But he worked hard, and it was a farm. And we had horses, but the horses were draft horses. And I had an uncle that would actually put me on a horse when I was 3 years old and let me ride. And when I was 10, I had saved up $50, went to the local livestock auction and bought my first horse for $50. Didn't get a saddle with, so I rode her home bareback for about 2 miles. And that was the beginning of my ownership of horses. But even before that, I would jump on the draft horses when they came around close. And they would put up with me for a while. And when they got tired, they'd go under a low tree and knock me off. But I was doing that. I thought I was driving those horses. My granddad did a lot of putting up hay, and he would give me the reins to the tandem. It'd be two draft horses pulling out wagon, and he would throw the hay on, and I would go from pile to pile. I later on figured out that the reins were tied to the wagon before they ever got to my hands. I had no control at all. They were all verbal command broke, so a get up and a whoa and a gee and a ha for right and left, and he had complete control of them. So I thought I was driving those horses to pick up hay, but I was actually just along for the ride. But that was my beginning, you know, with horses. I've had them since I was 10 years old, just had a love for them. Anytime I had a chance to ride a horse, I worked for a wonderful gentleman named Mr. Powers, who had a true ranch. He was a true old-time rancher, had quarter horse mares, bred them to Appaloosa stallions, and if he got color, he could register those. And that was my first horse-paying job. He hired me to break those horses. He didn't like to break them before they were 3 years old. They'd never been handled. So we had to rope these horses and snub them down. And in 30 days, he wanted me to have more they could be used on a ranch. So I had my work cut out for me, and we had a lot of rodeos, but also a great learning experience and some great times.
Did you ever think, as you were growing up and you were getting into working with the horses, did you ever think that maybe you would do something a little different outside of the horse industry, or was this always your passion?
You know, it was something I knew I would always be involved with, but I didn't have any idea how I could make a living at it. I was dealing mostly in my early training with quarter horses, and there was not a lot of money back then in the quarter horse game. And I mentioned to you earlier, and you mentioned already, that Dwayne Lucas, I've known him an awful long time. And we were running quarter horses together in Oklahoma and Kansas and living in the back of our pickup trucks and basically both trying to just figure out where the next meal was coming from. So I always wanted to, but it was something that kind of just developed. Right out of high school, I went in the Marine Corps. I spent a tour in Vietnam. When I got back, I used the GI Bill to get a degree from Kansas State University. And with that degree was in education. So I was going to be a school teacher. And part of my motive was to have the summers off to have my horse games going. And so I did that and actually ended up teaching physical education to elementary kids. And I incorporated the horses. I would bring horses to the phys ed classes and give lessons and let the kids ride the horses. And then later that transformed into starting a horsemanship program for Kansas State University. And I'm proud to say, although I have nothing to do with it now and haven't been back there for a few years, it is still going. And I started off with Western Horsemanship 1. They could get a college credit for learning how to ride a Western horse, very basic horsemanship. And then I got advanced so they could get 2. And I was had no expertise with the English part of it, so I hired a girl to start the English. And by the time I left Kansas, you could go to Kansas State and take horsemanship 1 and 2 with the Western appeal and 1 and 2 with the English and get 4 college credits for riding horses. So it's a very popular course, and it's done well, and they've expanded it and refined it and do a much better job today than my feeble beginnings.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. And I'm just curious, now that you've been involved with the horse business for, what, more than four decades, I guess, and you pursued this as your career, do you ever wonder what your life would look like if you had not gone that direction, decided to pursue being a teacher full-time?
I had a couple opportunities. In the Marine Corps, I had a chance to go to officer school, and at 17 years of age, all I could see was I was going to be committed for about 8 years, and that sounded like a long time. So I didn't do it. Later on, I'm thinking, I might have been able to retire about 37 or 8 and taking up horses then, but I did not do that. And then with the teaching, I just didn't see that happening. But I started racing. I took out my first trainer's license in 1971, and I raced horses at Blue Stem Downs in Emporia, Kansas, and in Eureka Downs. And it was tough. I was looking back, just looked up some statistics a couple of days ago. Some of my favorite horses back then, one of them was Going Jet. He's a Jet Deck son. And he had won a futurity as a yearling, actually. And he was a AAA racehorse, which is the highest rating that the quarter horse can get. And I thought he was a really nice horse. And I looked up, and he'd started 34 times. He had one win, 9 seconds, 4/3, and made $2,374.
Wow.
I had a mare by Top Deck named Miss Moon Rebel. She started 40 times. She won the Annandale Stakes in Nebraska, had 8 wins, 5 seconds, 5/3, and made $4,102. And Mr. Sooner Jet ran 79 times with 10 wins, 10 seconds, 10/3, and made $5,256. So we could not win a race, pay for the gas, pay the jock mount, and buy a couple win pictures, and, you know, break even, basically. So it was kind of hard to look at that and figure out how you're going to make a living with that kind of, horses that you're working with at that time.
I'm talking with trainer Ron Stevens here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. If you are just joining us, Ron has spent many, many years working in Aiken, South Carolina, at Aiken Training Track. He's been around so many top horses that we'll talk about in the next 30 to 40 minutes here on the program. He spent time working with Cott Campbell and Dogwood Stable and so many of those legendary horses. We'll get to them as well. First of all, though, Ron, I'd be remiss if I didn't stop for just a second and thank you for your service in the Marine Corps. Really do appreciate that. And that is a sacrifice that I know not just myself, but so many people across the country really do appreciate.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And it was an honor to do it, and it was good for me. It made a 17-year-old kid grow up fast and, as I mentioned, paid for a college education. So it was good, but thank you.
Let me go back to something you mentioned about Hall of Fame trainer Dwayne Lucas. You mentioned riding in the back of pickup trucks and trying to just make a name for yourselves and get things going. Dwayne Lucas was looking for his next meal and riding in the back of a pickup truck. Are you kidding me?
He not only was riding, we were sleeping in the back of the pickup trucks because we couldn't afford motel rooms.
You don't picture guys like Dwayne Lucas or Bill Mott told the story when he was on this program talking about how he tried to get stalls at a very small racetrack at one point and couldn't get stalls because they said his horses weren't good enough at that point. And you don't picture these Hall of Fame trainers, you know, going through those types of trials and tribulations, but they all have.
Yes, that's right. And, I had the same issue because once that I decided I wanted to train racehorses, I didn't know anything about it. My first horse I ran with steel shoes on. I had roached his mane off so the jockey had no mane to grab a hold of. I was just as green as they come. But I decided that I couldn't make a living at non-parimutuel racetracks. So I contacted the race secretary at Delta Downs. I wanted about 8 or 10 stalls. I ended up with 3, I think, and I had to go off the grounds to get a stall. That was where I went to the first parimutuel meet. And then I kept calling out the Centennial Racetrack in Denver, Colorado, with the same results. And they wanted me to name the horses. And I had a couple of brood mares that had run decent. And I even included their names and finally ended up getting a couple of stalls out there. But it was a tough go You know, I didn't have big owners spending a lot of money. And so to get stalls at a parimutuel track was very, very tough in the beginning.
Did you know, as you were riding around with Wayne Lucas in those early days, that he had the potential to turn out to be this super trainer that he has?
Well, he's always stood out. You know, Wayne's very creative, very inventive. He does things the right way. You know, he'd walk by every other barn. It might be trash out front and so on. His would be clean, as you can see, flowers hanging. First time I've seen rocks painted white out in front of the barn. So he's always run a classy outfit, thought way outside the box, and has been a super horseman as long as I've known him.
The other name that we mentioned, or I mentioned at the top of the show during my introduction, was the name J.J. Pletcher, who, when he came on the show in 2017, I had the chance to meet him with Todd in person a couple of times prior to that, but it was such a delight to hear his story. And there's a guy, you talk about a guy that's a fantastic ambassador for the sport and one hell of a horse trainer. J.J., I don't think he gets the credit he deserves quite often. He is just spectacular. How did that relationship come about?
Well, that's a fantastic story. I didn't know him that well in the beginning. In fact, you know, Todd, as you know, trained a lot of dogwood horses, and I got to know Todd better. Todd was very young when I was running my horses back in the 70s. But J.J. was training horses at La Mesa Park in Raton, New Mexico. And when I first took some horses to the track, I actually went to Nebraska for a couple of quarter horse meets that were parimutuel. And I did that in the summer. And with four horses, I think I ended up being second leading trainer. And we ran these horses every weekend for 4 weeks. And so a couple guys approached me, hey, how about training our horses? Well, even those purses at parimutuel back then, I already gave you some of the earnings that those horses made. Part of that was at those tracks. So I went to Delta Downs, I went to Centennial, where they had mixed meets. They were running quarter horses and thoroughbreds, and quickly learned that I needed to phase out the quarter horses and get into the thoroughbreds. The purses were better, and the better horses you got, the better tracks you could go to. So my circuit back then was a couple of tracks in Nebraska, Centennial, and some of the fair meets tracks at different little cities like Pueblo around Colorado, and then Raton, New Mexico, where La Mesa Park was, and then Rolito Downs in Tucson. So when I got to La Mesa, J.J. Pletcher was the big trainer there. He had the best horses. He was always leading trainer. And I never got to know him real well, but he was always friendly. He was always cordial. He was always anything you'd ask, he would be good to deal with. And then, of course, when the association with Todd came about and Dogwood Stable later on, then J.J. and I really got to know each other better than, and we had old stories to talk about, even though we weren't intimate friends back there at that time.
What eventually led to the decision to pick up and move to South Carolina?
Well,
I guess it was Georgia first, right?
Let me tell you two quick stories of how I kind of got to there. When I took the horses to Nebraska and the guys asked me to train, I quit my teaching job in the middle of the school year. My wife had a good government job. She quit it, came with me. We had a small mobile home we pulled behind us, had two daughters. My wife was my high school sweetheart. Her name's Julie. We've been married for 55 years. We dated 5 years before that. And she has ponied for me. She has been secretaries at farms. She's been office secretary. She's muck stalls. She's done it all and been my best supporter and my best friend for all these years. So when I said I wanted to quit my job and go to the track, she just said, okay, I'm coming with you. And we had some great times then. My daughters still talk about those racetracks and all the good friends we made. But it was kind of hectic. We were moving the girls to two or three schools a year, and I needed something a little more stable. So I took a job managing Fairweather Farm in Texas. It was a beautiful farm. We had Bar Rula, who'd won the Champion of Champions as a quarter horse. We had six or seven thoroughbreds, including Botchery, who was a full brother to Foolish Pleasure. And it was a beautiful farm, and things were going well. And after about 2 years, Bobby Powell, who a lot of people out there know and know well. He was an inspector for Facy Tipton for years and years. He was also the farm manager for Mike Rutherford, one of my longtime clients, and farm manager for a gentleman named Mr. Greenberg, who had Rutledge Farm up in Virginia. And Bobby came to the farm and looked at the yearlings and asked if I was happy there in Texas. And after thinking about it, I said, well, maybe I could be happier. So he had just been to Dogwood Stable and looked at their yearlings, and Cod had said he was looking for someone with racetrack training and farm management experience. And so Bobby gave him my name, Cod called me, and I flew to Atlanta, interviewed, and got the job with Dogwood Stable. So I moved there in 1981 with my family to a farm which Cod had built south of Atlanta in Greenville, Georgia. We had a three-quarter mile track, two very nice barns, and it was a beautiful farm, kind of in the middle of nowhere. And that's how I became acquainted with Cod Campbell and Dogwood Farm, and that's where my career went from backwoods bush tracks to the big time.
Well, I've got about a minute or so left, minute and a half, Ron, before I have to get to the bottom of the hour commercial break. But do you remember what it was like walking into that farm for the first time and meeting Cot Campbell for the first time?
It was. Like I said, he'd flown me up there for an interview, so he picked me up at the airport and drove me down to the farm, and I was very impressed with him. And one thing he told me that I've quoted many times was he said, you know, he needed somebody with my experience and love for racing, and he said, I could sell ice cubes to Eskimos. And so together we ought to do pretty well, and I found that to be true. Cot was a remarkable man, and the reason that I got to have all the great experiences with the top echelon trainers and horses.
Yeah, and a huge void left in the sport of thoroughbred racing after his passing, no doubt about it. Talking with trainer Ron Stevens here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Going to continue this visit in the second half of the show. We'll talk about some of those top Dogwood stables that he's been around, Dogwood horses that he has been around for Dogwood stables. We'll do that in the second half of the show, and we'll tell you a little bit more about the Aiken Training Center and some of the things that if you ever get a chance to visit, you want to make sure you check out. That's next on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
The heat is on in February at Fasig Tipton. Fasig Tipton is still accepting entries for the 2021 Fasig Tipton Kentucky Winter Mix Sale, the last breeding stock sale of the season. In 2020, the sale produced scorching results with a $575,000 sale-topping broodmare prospect, a $310,000 in-foal broodmare, and a $265,000 short yearling. Enter now for the Fasig Tipton Kentucky Winter Mix Sale to be held February 8th and 9th in Lexington, Kentucky. Where will you be?
Well, Fasig's family, basically. Some of the guys that work here I've known for 30 years. I just felt really supported, and they're great communicators. They try to help in whatever you do.
Fasig Tipton has a sale for every market, every segment in the industry. There's multiple opportunities where you're going to have plenty of good buying and selling situations.
Great customer service. I'm not only a buyer with them, but I'm a seller, and I've always been well taken care of.
There's a lot of different things that sometimes you need at a sale, and Fasig Tipton is there every step of the way.
They show year after year that they're ethical and they're fair, and they enjoy what they do. But when you're around people that have a combination of all those things, you know, you can't lose.
Introducing racing's newest partnership experience, the Horse and Julep Racing Club. Come see what makes us so different. The inaugural partnership club is forming right now and will purchase yearlings at the Keeneland January sale under the eye of rising star agent Phil Hager. The horses will go to historic Darby Dan Farm, whose land has raised no fewer than six Kentucky Derby winners. Partners should plan for a meetup there to visit the farm, the horses, and the best of the bluegrass. Visit horseandjulep.club today to reserve your spot. Horseandjulep.club.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
At the top of the lane, Fighting Motion's kicking on. Mr. Frisky's not finding. Summer's full. Unbridled, though, is still cruising up on the outside. Craig Perrette gives him his head now, and Unbridled takes the lead. Summer's full tries to go with him on the inside of these two. Summer's full and Unbridled. Summer's full is playing the better of the two with a 16th to go. And Summer's full has turned the tables on Unbridled. It's Summer's full and Fat Joe to win the Preakness from Unbridled. Mr. Frisky, a distant third, and Music Prospect, a Fighting Notion, Land Rush, Kentucky Jazz, Baron DeVoe, and JR's Horizon.
A little redemption in the 1990 Preakness Stakes for Summer Squall, the Dogwood Stable color bearer who got the victory over Kentucky Derby hero Unbridled. And Summer Squall, the winner of 13 of 20 lifetime starts, more than $1.8 million in purse earnings. He was pretty darn good, and we're going to spend time talking about him in the second half of the program. Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, visiting with trainer Ron Stevens, and you got a chance to hear his background and his story in the first half of the program. Now we're going to focus on some of the outstanding horses he's been around in his career and in his time working with Dogwood, and one of those is indeed Summer Squall. A quick reminder that if you missed any portion of the program, head back to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can listen to a podcast of this show and all of our Trainer Talk shows at your leisure, horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on Apple Podcasts. Well, Ron, I have to tell you that memory for me, anyways, in 1990, pretty special, seeing Summer Squall run down Unbridled. I was a big Unbridled fan, but, you know, you couldn't help but be a fan of Summer Squall either.
Well, I tell you what, just listening to that stretch again like I have a thousand times still gives me goosebumps. That was pretty exciting. And, you know, Cott had done a fabulous job of getting started with syndication, but that really put him on the map. That was a real – Summer Squall was a stamp of, you know, really making his mark. And, of course, that just boiled over and helped me out too. So, great memories. We were talking about getting to Aiken. When we came to Aiken, Summer Squall came to Aiken to be broke. We bought him out of the summer sale from Will Farish. And he was a handful. He was a kind of an ornery little cuss. But he was an athlete. And I remember back on the catalog page when we looked at him, I had written some things like a little small, studdish, didn't have the – he kind of had inset eyes. We used to call him, I guess, pig eyes, but now we call him Summer Squall eyes. But he's a very intelligent colt, but he was a little on the ornery side. But I've had big letters on that page, athlete. He was just so athletic, so quick, so light on his feet that he really got your attention.
Do you find that sometimes
he was fun to break, but he was a handful, and we ran him in the trials here, and I'm the only trainer that got him beat as a two-year-old. He was 5-for-5, ending up by winning the hopeful. But Neil Howard, who trained him, was very kind. He's told people that Ron had sent him a baked cake, and all they had to do was take him out of the oven, which was, helped me out a little bit too. So I appreciate that, and Neil and I are very good friends and have been for a long time. He's a great guy and a great trainer. But Summer Squall kind of put us on the map, and as you said, got redemption for the Kentucky Derby. I was there. I thought he had it won, but I think the crowd and some other things got him. But he came back and redeemed himself, and of course won the Jim Beam, the Bluegrass, the Hopeful, the Saratoga Special. And I don't think he got enough credit as a stallion. A lot of people know that he produced some nice mares, Broodmare sire, but he also produced Charismatic, you know. And everybody remembers him and what happened at the Belmont with Chris Hantley. But and of course, he had some runners, too, like, of course, Storm Song. We picked her out at a September yearling sale, and she went on to be a champion and won the Breeders' Cup up in Canada. So, Summer Squall will always have a big soft spot in my heart.
You use the word ornery to describe him. He kind of had that personality and disposition. Do you find, Ron, that sometimes it actually helps a horse to have that type of demeanor when they get into, say, a stretch battle, or they get into the heat of battle in some respects when they're at the races?
Absolutely. He was a smart colt, but he had to learn things, you know, the hard way. And he just wasn't always cooperative. Like when I ran in a trial, he was looking at the crowd, and he didn't care about the gate opening and the other horses breaking. But the next time, when he ran at Keeneland, he won by 13 lengths. He had it all figured out. So, and he was tough. You know, the Hopeful was probably one of the most, I don't know, it took everybody a long time to get over that, because they had to wait so long because there was just a tiny hole, and he made his own hole. He just shoved through and got the win, and they almost took him down for that. But that's the kind of horse he was. He was tough. He was gritty, and that's okay. You know, you can channel that in the right way. You've got you something special.
Who's the toughest horse that you've ever been around?
Probably a mare named Donna Caulkey. Caught was one of the first people to go to England and get some horses like Dominion, who was a nice stakes horse. And then everybody started doing it. So he went to, had a doctor, a veterinarian, go to Argentina. And we bought two fillies up here, Fazana and Donna Caulkey. It's D-A-N-A-C-A-L-Q-U-I. People don't really remember, but she was a nice mare. She won the Sheepshead Bay. But a funny story at the farm, it was just before we came to Aiken. I had a policy that when the horses came in, we wanted to get their temperature, check them out. And I also had a policy that I wouldn't ask my grooms to do anything I wouldn't do. So when the groom came up and said, I need your help getting the temperature of this mare, I knew something was up. And especially when I saw all the other grooms huddled around there, probably waiting to see me get kicked real good. So I walked up to the stall, and I put my hand on her head, and I ran it up, touched her ear, and I said, 100 degrees, right on the money, and I turned and walked away. The next morning, the groom couldn't catch her in the stall, and I went in, and she wheeled and fired with both hind legs, and I grabbed some bars and hung there like a monkey, and she kept firing, and then she'd look at me and adjust a little bit and fire some more. When she got tired, I dropped down and got out. But she was very, very tough that way. The veterinarian never got a Casnix operation on her before she raced. Farrier never got hind shoes on her at the farm. I trimmed her myself. And when the vet had her tranquilized as much as he could with straw bales behind her and tried the Casnix, she's kicked those bales around like they were toothpicks. So, and it, probably the funniest story I remember was when she was racing, after she had won the Sheepshead Bay, Cott and I were up there, and we were getting ready to leave and walking down the shed row saying goodbye to the horses. And as we walked by, she charged, hit the webbing, and her teeth snapped, and it sounded like a rifle going off. And Cott didn't even break stride. He just kind of looked at her and said, well, goodbye to you, Donna, and we just kept on walking. Now, I will say that we bred her a couple of times, and as a broodmare, she mellowed out, and she was fine. But she was one tough son of a gun.
All right, let's flip that around a little bit. How about the horse that you would say was probably the most perfect young lady, the most perfect gentleman that went on to maybe do some really good things on the racetrack?
I'm going to have to switch from a dogwood horse. I've had wonderful clients, fantastic clients over the years. And one of those was Mr. Ned Evans with Spring Hill Farm. And we had the pleasure of having a horse that actually got a reputation for not being that gentle, but he was falsely accused, and that would be Quality Road. Quality Road was a fantastic racehorse, made over $2 million, and should have made way more than that. But Mr. Evans, he usually sold most of his colts and kept his fillies. And at the sales back in that day, he was having me look at most of the yearlings and kind of give him an appraisal of what I thought. And I love this colt. It's big, strong, nice-looking colt with a kind eye. And I said, you know, I really like him. I wouldn't give him away. And he did RNA him in September and kept him. He sent him to me on the 1st of November. And he said, now, I want you to push this colt because I really want to get rid of the colt, so I'm going to put him back in the Keeneland two-year-old sale. And I said, okay. I looked at the big colt. It's already November. But we went to work, and he broke like a puppy dog. Just never took a bad step, never did anything wrong, perfect in the gate. And when we started galloping him and I saw the movement of this colt, I told Mr. Evans, I'm not sure you want to sell him. You might want to hang on to him. Well, he said, no, I want to sell him. And I trained horses for Mr. Evans for 20 years, and he was a man that when he made up his mind about something, that was the way it was going to be, and you didn't change it too often. But Chris Baker became his farm manager back about that time, and I got him on my side. He saw him train and loved him too, and we ganged up on him and said, we really think you ought to keep this colt. And to his credit, and we were probably partly lucky too, he kept Quality Road, and that was the last really nice horse that he had. He won the Florida Derby, was a favorite for the Kentucky Derby, or co-favorite, and then got a quarter crack. But where his reputation came up as being a handful was at the Breeders' Cup, where he was like co-favorite for the $5 million race. And just before the race, the TV helicopter came out taking pictures, and he got a little bit rattled. And I promise you, and I swear that if they'd have given him 30 seconds to settle and just to walk him in a circle to head it in, he would have been fine. Because after that race, Todd Pletcher, who had him and trained him, schooled him. He never did anything wrong in the gate again. He ran many more times, never did anything wrong in the gate again. But they were in a hurry, I guess. They grabbed him and they twisted it in the air and they threw a blindfold on him. And they had 1,200 pounds of muscle that said, no, you're not going to make this happen. So he got a reputation of being a bad gate horse, which he was not. He was one of the easiest, nicest colts that I've worked with.
Talking with trainer Ron Stevens here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. If you are just tuning in, you missed most of the show already. Guess what? Here's a guy that spent many, many years working with some of the top young horses we've seen in the sport. He did that at Aiken Training Track in South Carolina. And as you heard him mention, he worked with people like Cott Campbell and Edward Evans and some of the top names in the game. How about some of the other people, Ron, that when you think back on your career are people that you're going to remember fondly because of either they gave you the chance to work with them or you got the chance to spend a lot of time with them?
Well, I've been around so many people, and you know, I'm just blessed that I had the opportunity to work with the caliber of owners and people that we've worked with and the horses. I'm going to mention one guy, and that's my partner. I hired him 25 years ago. His name is Brad Stauffer. He worked for Mr. Duchessois, the owner of Arlington Park, and he came to Aiken with the Duchessois horses. And I hired him as a foreman, and then he became assistant trainer and then a partner. And we've been partners for a good many years. And I announced my retirement 4 or 5 years ago, but I was not telling the truth. I couldn't stay away from the barn. So I go in every day, and it's better now. You know, Brad's calling the shots, and I get to mess with the horses and have hands-on again. So that worked out very well. And he's been a blessing. We've been together 25 years with never a crossword, never an argument and disagree on everything dealing with the horses. Other clients I've had, I've been blessed with. I've trained for Governor Barry Jones. I've had horses for John Nayrud. After Mr. Evans passed away, and one of my other great owners was Bill Carl, who founded Old Colony Insurance. He passed away. I had a owner named Mr. Greenberg, who had Rutledge Farm. And he passed away, and I was telling people we need to get younger clients. About that time, John Nayrud called and wanted to know if we'd take a horse for him. Well, at that time, he was 100 years old, and John sent a horse, and he named him Final Chapter. He said, that's going to be my last horse. So we took Final Chapter, and Brad communicated with him most of the time, and he would say things like, young man, speak up. I'm 100 years old. I can't hear what you're saying. And Final Chapter, to make a long story short, he was a decent horse. He won a trial here at the Aiken Trials that we have every March. And then he went on to win some races in New York. And the last funny story I have about Mr. Nayrud, who, of course, trained Dr. Fager way back, he said one day, he said, you know, when I was born and came into this world, they put me in diapers. He said, they got me in diapers again. And I'm 101 years old now. So I've had owners like that that has made this fun, extremely interesting, and I've still got great owners. Mark Greer sends us quality horses every year, and I guess some of the my favorite stories are dealing with small time or inexpensive horses. We have a gentleman who lives here in Aiken, Jim Miller, that picked out a horse from Raleigh McDonald's consignment and paid $5,500 for her. We broke her, and her name was Daisy Divine. She's a multiple graded stakes winner, grade one winner, actually, and she made $1 million. She sold for $1.3 million. He paid $5,500. Mr. Greenberg, who I mentioned, he bought nice horses, but he would support Virginia Tech's horse program and buy some of their horses every year. And, of course, all the colts they would gild. So he sent me a gilding one year, and I think he told me it doesn't even show up in a record what he paid. I think it was about $1,200. And that horse turned out to be Researcher, who won the big race at Charlestown a couple of times and became a millionaire. So these are stories that, you know, warm my heart. When the little guy can get in there and not spend a whole lot of money, and that's what keeps you humble. You know, you can pay $1 million for a horse, and as we all know, he'll get outrun by a $5,500 horse. So those are great memories.
You know, there's a saying that says that, you know, hope springs eternal when you have a good two-year-old in the barn. And really, I would take that a step further and say any two-year-old in the barn, you still have hope that, you know, hey, this could be the next great one. And that's one of the cool things about thoroughbred racing. You experienced that, Ron, every single day, year in and year out, where you were getting these really nice young horses. And you would probably look at them, I would say, and think, okay, maybe this is the next great one. When you would see them for the first time, what were some of the things that went through your mind and some of the things that you wanted to make sure you did with them to get them started in the right way?
Well, that's a good question. And as everybody in the business knows, you've got to treat them as individuals. We have a program. You know, we want them to have the best feed. We want them to have the best farrier. We love Aiken because I feel it's one of the safest tracks. I was counting the other day, trying to count up, and I think I've trained close to 700 horses here in Aiken. And I've had two bad casualties, two accidents where the horses had to be put down. And we've had some chips and buck shins and a tendon or two. But the soundness, which is a huge, huge issue in our business right now, is so important. And Aiken Training Track is, you know, it's a mile track. It's got banked gentle turns. It's got a wonderful cushion that we have a man that's been taking care of tracks and doing horses for 50 years that keeps it in splendid condition. We have the right equipment. And I'm just sad that people have kind of forgotten about Aiken. If you want a safe, fantastic place to train a racehorse, I believe you cannot find a better place than Aiken, South Carolina.
There is a lot to that racetrack, not just the surface, but there is history, there is tradition. And one of those is included in the logo for Aiken Training Track. It's a big live oak tree, and there is a lot more to that tree than just a picture on a logo. Tell me the story of that tree and the legend behind it.
Okay, well, I'm old, but that was actually before my time, but that's called the Blue Peter tree. And
yep.
Blue Peter was a horse that was one of the favorites for the Derby, and he came down here to Aiken and got shipping fever, which nowadays with our newer medications and so on, we probably could have saved him. But at that time, he did succumb, and he's buried under that tree, and it's called the Blue Peter tree. So there's a bit of history.
Yeah, I love that story. He was considered the favorite for the Kentucky Derby and had shown so much promise. And his trainer said, well, he's probably the best horse I've ever trained. And then, as you alluded to, things just didn't work out for Blue Peter, but he's honored there. There are a couple of other plaques at the base of that tree. The other cool thing that I love about Aiken, and it's the first thing that I thought of when I started diving into doing some of the research, is the Aiken Trials, which are held every spring. That is so unique, and it's such an amazing event. Tell me a little bit more about that for people that have never heard of it.
The Aiken Trials have been going on basically since the track back in the 40s. And
yeah,
it used to be where they would run, you know, dozens and dozens of horses. Right now, typically the last few years, we try and have six races. We'll have three horse races for two-year-olds going a quarter of a mile just down the chute. And then we'll have three races for older horses going 4.5 furlongs. And it's a fun time. Unfortunately, I say unfortunately, it got very, very competitive in that some of my owners feel like they're running in a Kentucky Derby, and it put a little bit more pressure than I would like to, because to me, it's just such a wonderful training tool. The horses come out of the gate. We have a 6-horse starting gate here. So they come out in company and they run, and there's a crowd on both sides of the track screaming and yelling, and they go down there, they get their picture taken afterwards. It's just an experience that you can't duplicate. And going back to Summer Squall, you know, he needed that. When that gate opened, he was looking at all that stuff, and he was running them down at the wire. He was catching them about 4 more strides. He went by them, but he learned from that. And like I said, when Neil Howard got him and ran him just a few days later, he knew what it was all about. And that's because of here. And I mentioned those 7 stakes winning fillies from one crop that Mr. Evans sent us. One of them was Gold Mover. And I ran her in the trials. Another one was With All Probability. And Gold Mover was a major stakes winner. And one of the horses was a millionaire, a well-bred filly. And Mr. Evans was very much about running him in the trials. And we ran a lot of his horses there, as a lot of my other clients have done also. But it's a great day, family day, tailgating, hat contest going on, just a fun time that you can come out and enjoy yourself. And as a side note, that happened to be the last big outdoor event before the COVID shutdown last spring. We had the trials. The very next week was the steeplechase, and it did not happen. They shut everything down. So we have that feather in our bonnet right now.
Yeah, and it was a day where you paid tribute to the late owner breeder Gus Schickendance as well, who passed away in June of 2019. That was a very classy touch, and I know somebody that had an impact there, but certainly in Canada as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. And his trainer, Mike Keough, has been sending horses here for a good many years. Unfortunately, the family's kind of getting out of the business issue. This is the first year Mike will be here for a long time, which leads me to, again, be sad about that and just say that we've got barns empty, nice barns. So if anybody's out there still looking for a place to send a horse or bring some horses with your own trainer, we can set you up and we'll give you a good deal. I was president for 15 years. I sound like I'm back in the saddle, but I just fell in love with Aiken. It's my favorite place. And, you know, I like golf and horses, and this is one of the best places to be for both.
I now see why Cott told you that he felt like you could sell ice cubes to the Eskimos. So I'm starting to get that sense, Ron.
Yes.
Yeah, trainer Ron Stevens here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. Ron, let's talk about a couple of the other notable horses that you had the privilege to be around. And the first name that comes to mind is another Dogwood horse by the name of Storm Song, who was a champion juvenile filly. Tell me a little bit more about her.
Well, as I mentioned earlier at the September sale, when she was a yearling, we bought her there. I can remember Cott was, you know, as a trainer, I'm looking at things and I want that straight leg and I don't want a lot of conformation defects. He would forgive a few things and he proved to be right. We had a lot of horses that would not pass the vet today that turned out to be super race horses. Now, she was not one of those, but she didn't look like a Summer Squall. The Summer Squall kind of marked his horses with his eye. They weren't big, robust horses. They weren't real leggy horses. She had a foreign pedigree on the dam side and looked more like the mama. And I can remember we both liked her. Cott liked her. I loved her. Just before she was coming up to the ring, he said, "Ron, why don't you run down and look at her one more time?" And I did. I ran down to the barn, looked at her, and I came back. I said, "I really like her, Cott." And he bought her. He bid on her, and he liked her. And we worked well together like that over the years. But he was, you know, he would have loved her more had she looked like Summer Squall, is what I'm saying. So I found that very interesting. But she was another filly that was easy to break, kind of nondescript. I didn't know she was as good as she was. I'll just be honest with you. When she was here as a yearling and being broke, she was nice. She was push button, did everything right. But I did not have one of those aha moments like I did with Summer Squall when Summer's Gold was part of a general partnership. Five horses got sold 40 shares in those five. And we had an Aladar. We had a Summer's Gold. It was a Storm. Not Storm Cat, but Stormbird. But when we let them breeze the first time and finish, we work them up with two-minute licks and going in 13s and so on. And once we were ready to turn them loose that day, we had three or four nice colts, and we turned them loose, and Summer Squall just took off and put by eight lengths on those horses in the last eighth of a mile. And Cott was there. All of our mouths fell open and said, wow, we got something special here. Well, Storm Song didn't do that to me, but she was just a quality filly and a really nice filly to be around. And won the Breeders' Cup, so shows what I know.
Yeah, won the Breeders' Cup, did it very impressively. How about, it looks like we're down to the final 2.5 minutes or so, Ron, but I'll get a word in for our friend Palace Malice, who won the Belmont Stakes. How about Palace Malice?
Palace Malice was not an easy horse. He's tough, and I was talking to Chris Baker last year about him, if he got any more mellow in the breeding shed. And he said, not Andre. He's just plain mean. But that's going back to what we were talking about with Summer Squall. Aggressive, not vicious, but he was his man, and he wanted things his way, and I understand he's still that way. I just quickly mentioned Carolina, yeah. We had for the Eclipse people, who are doing a fantastic job as syndicators and had a great year this year. But we broke Carolina here, and she ended up making $1.5 million and selling for $3 million. So, we've just been blessed from the time we made the move and hooked up with Dogwood until we came to Aiken until today. We've been blessed with outstanding clients and outstanding horses. Makes your job easy.
Well, there you have it. He's trainer Ron Stevens, my special guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. We could have spent much more time talking about some of the top horses that he's been around, because there were plenty more in his 30-plus year career in Aiken, South Carolina. What a ride it's been for Ron Stevens, and fantastic stories, fantastic start to his career. If you missed any portion, head back to our website, horseracingradio.net. Check out the podcast. Do yourself a favor. If you missed anything, listen to the whole show, because he was really, really tremendous. What a great visit. Ron Stevens here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. My thanks to him. My thanks to my producer, Lee Delapina, in our Lexington studios. Don't forget to follow us on social media at HRN on Twitter and Horse Racing Radio Network on Facebook and Instagram. For Ron Stevens, I'm Mike Penna. Thanks for listening to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton.